If the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, then the way to the world's affection may well be through the foods one serves. This thought leads us to ask, which foods would you serve as your country's ambassador to the world?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 710th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Hokkaido who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki Janes on the board. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
And hey, we also have a room full of pretty girls led by Renee. Renee, you want to say hello for the crew?
Hello.
Okay. Folks, let's see here. It has been said that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. I can attest to that. Well, we all do get hungry, and we all get hungry every day. So this makes food the ultimate attractant, and thus a very effective means to sell. There is, in fact, a lot of selling that comes with food, as in the bonding of a family at its dinner table, a congregation at its potluck, a business community at its mixer, and politicians and constituents at their fundraisers. It thus follows that a nation's traditional foods can provide its ambassador with a means to sell the character of his or her country to the world. This can readily be seen and tasted by dining around the embassies of Washington, D.C., as witnessed by Summer Whitford's new book, Join Us at the Embassy. Miss Whitford's tasteful tour of D.C. embassies leads us to ask, which foods would you serve as your country's ambassador to the world? And here to help us go on a taste tour of Washington, D.C. embassies, we have Summer Whitford. Summer, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
So pleased to be aboard. Any sign of cherry blossoms in D.C. yet?
No, actually, we got a dusting of snow today, so the cherry blossoms are still in hiding.
They're still dormant. Okay, well, we kind of expected that. So, a career foodie with the motto, dine well, live fully, travel often. Gosh, I love that, but how on earth did you become a career foodie?
Well, I was lucky enough to spend most of my childhood in France and Germany. I was 14 when I came back to this country, and lucky enough to be in wine country, and my passion for food, my mother says, started even when I was five, and so I studied international affairs and languages in college, and I kept going back to food as the best representation of a country's culture, especially for Americans who don't really know that much about a culture when they travel overseas. It's a quick way to get introduced to all sorts of things.
And an interesting, also, you know, when thinking about how embassies around the world use their traditional foods to sell the character of their country, I, of course, began thinking about our country and what foods I would use to sell on the character of our country. And I got to thinking, there's an interesting one. Somebody emailed me, well, would it be buffalo or turkey or what would it be? And that's something we hope to play with as we go through this program. Summer, we always ask, who pays the way? I mean, you have this wonderful life of eating and drinking and dining and traveling and enjoying life. Does Monsanto Corporation pay the way?
Thankfully, no. I actually am a chef. My husband is also a chef, and together we worked in the restaurant business in Washington and some of the better restaurants and hotels, and then wanting to do our own thing and really focus on doing restaurant-style food for catered clients. We catered for the leadership of the House and Senate and lobby groups and embassy staff and some of the smaller embassies in Washington for 15 years.
Wow. So you have a good connection with the embassy crew then. I love the idea of Join Us at the Embassy, which, of course, is a tour of embassy dining. And how on earth did you get onto this idea of doing this wonderful story?
Well, I wish I could take credit for it, but I have a wonderful agent, Diane Nine of Nine Speakers, And she was listening to me and a friend of mine who was a restaurant chef who also catered for embassies talk about how people were always fascinated when we would tell them we were catering an embassy event, and they were fascinated by what the table looked like, what the dining traditions were, what the table manners and etiquette involved, and what kinds of food were served if they were introducing Americans to their cuisine and culture for the first time. And being a real foodie and a real geek, I loved nothing more than working with the protocol officer and the ambassadorial staff to learn as much as I could about the countries I hadn't visited and learning how to prepare those foods, but more importantly, why they felt they were important to represent their country. And that's why my book is through the eyes of the ambassadors, their spouses, and the people from that country.
So did in putting this together, did you go to these embassies of these new countries and say, hey, I've got a great idea for a book. Want to play?
Yes. Actually, we didn't do any countries unless they first agreed through the ambassador's office to participate, because it was so important that I not talk about what I thought was important, but that they share with me what they thought was important. And so in Washington, we're also different because we're the only capital city in the world where embassies regularly open their doors to the public.
Right, which was very interesting, too. So this is like anybody can go to these embassy parties?
Yes, it's wonderful. You can actually sign up for email announcements with some of them. They're also announced on different kinds of event websites. But for me, being a food and culture, I call myself a cultural magpie, because I'm so fascinated by other cultures and how food really can quickly give you a shorthand window into their religious traditions, gender roles, all sorts of holidays, everything from what kinds of crops can be grown. And here in Washington, for free or for a reasonable price, we can get to see world-class performances by opera companies, ballet companies, curated art exhibits, food and wine tastings, and it's just a fabulous opportunity to learn directly from the people of that country what they think is special about their cuisine and culture.
I might have to move to Washington, D.C. for a year for this. It would be
It's really fabulous. It's one of the most, it's my favorite aspect of living here in Washington.
It's the world.
It is.
It's a good way to do
it. And literally each embassy is a sovereign part of that nation's country, land, and government here in the United States.
So it's like traveling around the world in one city.
I always say it's getting to travel the world without ever having to pack your bags.
I like that. And I'd go through the airports either.
That sounds like
a lot of fun. Well, you know, as we get into these embassy dinners that you travel around, so essentially join us at the embassy. Is your tale of going from embassy to embassy around Washington, D.C., and in doing so, learning the culture and foods and rituals of these countries and really getting to visit that country without even going there. As we get into these meals, I have to ask, were there any do the embassies actually get into contests to see who can put on the best show? I ask because I once studied Chinese at UC Berkeley, and I lived in a house with four other guys, all of whom were pursuing graduate degrees in this and that, enology and intellectual history and all kinds of interesting things. And being five of us in one house, we got to, each one of us would cook dinner one night, and as we went through this season, we came to compete with each other to see who could do the best dinner.
And we didn't used to have that in Washington, but now we do. We're now getting ready to have what's become an annual competition of the best embassy chef.
Oh, okay.
And when I was beginning the research for my book in 2007, we had an embassy open house day in honor of the 54th anniversary of the establishment of the EU. And that every 6 months, the presidency of the EU changes country. And in this particular period, it was West Germany. And they thought it would be a really great opportunity to open the doors of the EU countries' embassies to the people of Washington, D.C., for them to get a chance to taste the food, meet the ambassadors, and learn about the culture firsthand. And I told all of my embassy contacts and the ambassadors and press, I said, be prepared. When people hear there is an event at an embassy in Washington, you literally sell out the tickets in a very short time. And they thought, well, we'll get 300 people. There were 42,000 people.
Wow.
So it's now an annual event, and we've now added the continent of Africa, we've added the continent of Asia, and the continent of South America. So you really get to see a whole
cross-section of the world.
Yes, and it's fabulous.
Okay,
children
hold on, Summer. Hold on. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking Summer Whitford. Join us at the embassy. We're going on a tour of our nation's capital's embassies. We're going to taste food from everywhere. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Okay. Oops, I said okay, and it was a hot mic. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain. We are back. We are talking food, not only food, but we're talking about the embassies, how the embassies of the world in Washington, D.C. Use food to sell the world on the character of their country. We're doing so with Summer Whitford, whose new book, Join Us at the Embassy, is a tour of those embassies and a wonderful experience. I'm jealous. Tell you the truth, I think that would be a wonderful way to spend some time in Washington. If I were marooned there for one reason or another, I think I would follow in Summer Whitford's footsteps as she goes from one embassy to the next, checking out the food and the culture. Summer, where do you begin with respect? How you have to sign up on a list to get involved in these embassy galas?
It's actually pretty easy. If you go to the embassy website, oftentimes there's a place where you can sign up for the email announcements that will come directly into your email box and tell you what's coming up at that embassy. There are some other websites that are nothing but a website devoted to embassy events. And then there are some Washington, D.C. organizations that let you know about what's going on at embassies.
Mm-hmm. And the embassies itself, how do these meals work? How are they set up so as to present a country to the community of Washington, D.C.?
Well, there's actually two different kinds of embassy events. There's the public events that are often held at the embassy, which the chancery, which is the place of business for the actual embassy. Or there's the private, smaller dinners and receptions that are held at the ambassador's residence. And that's usually where the bulk of real diplomatic work gets done.
Sure.
In Washington.
Sure.
But you can literally, for example, Chile is one of the countries in my book. They have two celebrations of their Independence Day, 18. One is a big public event that's held at the embassy, and they invite members of Congress, trade members that they do business with here in the United States, all sorts of expats that live here in Washington. And then they also have a similar celebration that's just for the Chilean expats and the ambassadorial staff and people like that. And what you get, and what I love about this particular celebration, is you get to see Chilean people enjoying their culture, and you really get a sense of what it would be like to visit Chile when they're celebrating this day.
Well, actually, you're actually going to Chile.
Because
those grounds are...
And so you get to hear the music. You get to see the decorations, what kind of of pottery and china the food is served on, what food is served, humitas. They serve empanadas. They make their pisco sours. And in my book, I actually include a recipe for the pisco sour that's served at the embassy. It's a really refreshing drink, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. What about all the rituals that are involved? You know, that each country has a kind of different rituals that have evolved over time to serve meals and especially...
Very much so. Elaborate rituals and much more clearly defined and structured than what we have here in the United States, because so many of the countries that are in my book, and there are 10 of them, have very old, ancient cultures behind them. They also have monarchies behind mm-hmm. them.
Because they've been around for a while, right?
They have. And, for example, Austria, the Habsburgs, ruled for 600 years. In France, you have a very long history of a monarchy, same thing. And they tend to have much more formal, structured approaches to table manners than we do. And so it can be a landmine if you're not really familiar with it.
That's what I'm wondering. In other countries, you're not supposed to eat with your right hand, or is it your left hand?
Almost every country that's Muslim, you'll find that you don't eat with the left hand. And in most European countries, you use your fork in the left and your knife in the right. And they generally don't pick those utensils up and down like we do in our country. And I address this in the book because growing up overseas, I always ate with my fork in my left and my knife in my right. But it can be daunting when you get to another country and you're at the table and there's an array of utensils in front of you and you may not have any idea when to use them, what to use with what course. And as well as the utensils, there's all sorts of things about where you place your elbows, your napkin, gift-giving and greetings are another whole area that I mm-hmm. talk about as well.
And do they have different kinds of greetings for when you arrive at these events? Yeah?
They do, and you'll find that Americans, we're very casual about our greetings and the use of the first name and the informal you expression. Most other countries, until you really know someone really well, you don't use the more formal greeting. For example, in France, they have a tradition called faire la bise, which means to make the kiss. Depending on what region you're in, you never give someone just one kiss on the cheek unless you're their lover or they're your spouse, because that's a sign of a different kind of intimacy. Where I live...
Well, what do you do then?
Well, in northeastern France, we almost always give three.
Three kisses?
A kiss on each cheek and then a final one. Now, if you go to southern France, they sometimes do as many as six.
Wow.
The Parisians tend to do two. And Alsatians, depending on which part of Alsace you're in, can do anywhere from two to three.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't realize this, and you're not used to all this
kissing
it can be a little daunting, especially for some of the men.
So all of these embassies, of course, have different kinds of traditions in, right?
They do. When you're a
newcomer, just peeking into the country for the first time, what do you do? How do you manage that?
You get my book.
Okay.
Because I address the greetings. For example, when I went to Jamhuri Day celebration, which is the Independence Day for Kenya, Kenya is a very, very ancient tribal culture. And in that culture, the elders are very, very much respected. And so they're also a very formal greeting culture. And there's a particular way that you greet someone. But in particular, there is a way you shake hands with an elder person or someone who's a very important person like the ambassador. And when I first met the ambassador, I knew this. And when I shook his hand properly, he was taken a little aback. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, I see that you've done your homework." And he was, you know, flattered that I took the time to make sure that I addressed him properly and greeted and shook his hand correctly.
I once flew into Cairo with my wife and daughter without doing my homework properly. We got into Cairo about 10 o'clock at night, and all of the women in the airport were in burqas from
head
to toe.
Oh, my.
But my girls had long blonde hair flying in the wind, you know, and I could tell in a second that something wasn't right. So we were sticking this blonde hair up into the hats, you know, trying to make amends, but not doing a very good job of it. What do you do when you foul up like that?
Well, I always try to carry with me certain kinds of head covering as a woman, because in so many cultures, head covering for women, depending on whether the religion or the culture or both, dictates it. For example, mm-hmm. Afghanistan is one of the countries in my book.
Right.
And not all parts of Afghanistan observe the burqa, but unfortunately, because of the tragedy that's going on in their country, most women are forced to. But you're generally safe if you're in an area where there are a lot of Westerners with a headscarf. And you generally want to make sure that your hair is kept completely underneath it. And I always have a scarf with me if I'm going to a country that's very Catholic, just to be on the safe side. And you learn very quickly, as a female especially, you don't want uncovered shoulders. And I wrote this book because I thought it was important to have a shorthand
sure.
for all of us when we go to another country.
But what do you do when you foul up like I did?
You know what I've discovered? People are very, very forgiving and understanding. And if you say, I'm so sorry if I have offended you, and you can actually ask them, what is the proper cultural tradition, I would very much like to make sure that I don't offend you or your family. And most people are really wonderful and understanding and nice. And they often will even give you a scarf if you don't have one.
Well, we're going to take a quick break with Summer Whitford, author of Join Us at the Embassy. When we come back, we're going to tour some embassies. I'm going to go to Afghanistan right away and see what it's like and taste its food without having to go there as a warrior, as an Epicurean. That was my idea. What is your motto again?
Dine well, live fully, travel often.
In Afghanistan, when we get back from this break, do stay tuned. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Well, I'm hungry, but that's usually the case, and I ran across this book called Join Us at the Embassy, which is about eating around the embassies of Washington, D.C. Oh, imagine it. What fun. Foods of the world. Not only of the world, but from the world. You go to these embassies, and you're traveling to a foreign country, literally and figuratively, and you don't even have to leave town or pack your bags, as Summer Whitford says in her book Join Us at the Embassy. And today we're going to travel around to some embassies, and we're going to start with Afghanistan. Why with Afghanistan? Because it's always been, since I read The Travels of Marco Polo, one of my favorite places to think about going without ever going there. How about you, Summer?
Me too. I'm actually, there might be a chance for me to actually go there this year, so I'm really looking forward to that. But being able to go to the embassy for me and interview the ambassador and his wife and reporters and military people and other Afghans gave me a really good opportunity to get a true sense of the culture from the side that we don't really get to see on TV very much, and that's that I got to see a human face instead
sure.
of the face of war.
Which would be really good. But let's talk about the food of Afghanistan, because it being a landlocked country way up high there in the high deserts, you think, goodness, what do they eat, rocks?
Absolutely. Some of the most incredible food I've ever eaten in my life. And that's because it is a country that is landlocked, but for centuries was part of the Silk Road. And so
And
you
the
have
Silk
the
Road being from the west to the east.
Correct. And what you get in Afghanistan because of the influence of the Silk Road and the fact that it was such an important area for centuries, you have influences from as far away as Greece. Alexander the Great came there. You have the Persians. Darius the Great invaded. You have Persian food influences. You see it in the palaus. You have the Rajas. And so you see the food of India and the Himalayans. You have the Far East.
And China and Japan.
You see Chinese, Mongolian, all of these influences in the food, and yet none of them predominate, which is why it's so distinctly unique and an expression of who the Afghan people really are.
So the food of Afghanistan is really the food of the Silk Road.
It is the food of the Silk Road, and it's absolutely clean and refreshing and aromatic, and it incorporates a balanced use of spices like cumin and yogurt, and you've got herbs like dill and fresh spinach, and lots of fresh fruit. Even though they're landlocked and a lot of it is desert and it can be very, very hot, and the land is not always arable. They're famous for their fruits and vegetables. And in Kandahar, grapes have been grown for thousands of years and made into raisins and been sent all over the ancient world and now the modern world.
Wow. And do you know that you think about where the water comes from in Afghanistan? Of course, it comes from the high mountain melt of the snows.
It does, exactly.
And those rub through the rocks and bring all of those minerals down to the valley floor. And so the earth is always being regenerated from those minerals high in the mountains, right?
It does. And as a result, even though if there are some areas that have had a drought for 30 years, there are other areas where the fruit is world famous. And so they're famous for peaches and apricots and almost every other kind of fruit that you can think of. And it's part of their diet on a regular basis, mostly for dessert, but it is incorporated. You'll find raisins in the rich palaus, which are the mm-hmm. rice dishes, and so you get a little bit of fruit, delicious lamb and goat, and then you also have not a lot of fish, but you will find wild game when they can find it is very much appreciated. And so it's a little
about
bit
the fresh
like Middle
breads.
Eastern.
Tell us about the fresh breads.
The Holy Trinity in Afghan food is naan, chai, and palau. And naan is made in a tandoori-style oven very, very quickly and easily put together, and it's stoked very early in the morning and kept hot continually. And so you can always have fresh, hot baked bread, which is absolutely essential at every meal in Afghanistan. And it's naan, just like you find in India.
Wow.
And it's absolutely delicious.
And the embassy dinner, was it fun?
The embassy dinner was one of my favorite. I went to many, many events as well as catering events over the years, but I have to say the ambassador and his wife were very gracious, and the local restaurant, Bamiyan, that supplied the food, created one of the most delicious meals I've ever had. And so for me, it was my favorite meal of the entire research project.
Well, gosh, we used up the first. Now we're stuck with finding the rest. Well, in that case, take us to Finland. What on earth could the Finns do to sell us on their country with their food? I mean, what, lutefisk?
Well, actually, there are so many things about the Finns that we don't know that it would actually fill its own book. For example, Finland has the cleanest, purest, most unadulterated source of dairy products in the world. So their cheese and their milk and their yogurt is absolutely stellar. It defies description how it tastes.
Really?
Yes. They're also famous for their crawfish, and they're very famous for their wild mushrooms. And because one quarter of Finland is above the Arctic Circle, their growing season is very, very short.
Mm-hmm.
But because the sun doesn't set, it's very intense. So the fruits and vegetables grow quickly, but have an even more intense flavor profile.
Wow.
And cloudberries, which are native to Finland, which look like a golden, small, round raspberry, are absolutely phenomenal. And lingonberries, which are, they're so delicious from Finland. They taste like no other lingonberries I've ever had.
And the embassy meal?
The embassy meals are, the chef at the Finnish embassy, when I went to a wonderful art exhibit, did everything from a beautiful gravlax buffet to the very famous potato dishes that they do. They do hot and cold. He had hot and cold pickled herring. He had all of the assorted breads. He served Swedish meatballs, which are actually a staple in Finland because Sweden controlled Finland for 600 years. And the other part that I thought was interesting about Finland is, in addition to the food, they also make their own homemade mead.
Oh,
and that was delicious served. And they served a drink called Koskenkorva, which is similar to vodka, but it's sweetened a little bit. And it's absolutely refreshing. And they also served wine from other countries. But most of the guests, we preferred the Koskenkorva. And so you don't really think of Finland. And, of course, reindeer is a staple. They call it the Finnish cow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's similar to, like, a venison in taste.
How did it taste? You know, given the thought that Finland has such wonderful dairy products, which means that good grass, right?
Very good grass.
How did the caribou taste?
The caribou, I've actually had caribou before, but the reindeer,
I'm sorry.
Because the ground and the area where the reindeer come from, which is the upper area in what we call Lapland, which is the Sami people, the meat tastes like venison, but it's a little bit richer because it's so cold where they come from. It's a little bit more marbled with fat,
mm-hmm.
not a lot, just enough to add texture and moisture and flavor.
Flavor.
And it's like venison, but a little bit like buffalo as well.
Wow, there's a combination.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you know, when we come back, I have the question that's been lingering with me ever since I picked up your book, and that is, which embassy serves the best food, Italy or France? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We are talking with Summer Whitford, author of Join Us at the Embassy. And hey, I forgot to invite you to participate, my fault. Please join us if you care to. Have a question about eating around the world? Well, ask Summer. And the phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson here. We're talking food with Summer Whitford and you, and we'd love to hear from you if you so desire, but when we get back, it's which is best, Italy or France, when it comes to food. Well, how's this for a model? Dine well, live fully, travel often. Sounds like fun to me, and it must be fun for Summer Whitford, author of Join Us at the Embassy. Summer, it must be fun to go to all of these embassies, but in considering your thoughts about these embassies, I just had to note in your book that you attended both the French and the Italian embassies, of which, of course, nobody would want to miss those two when it comes to food, right? But which one was best? And in your estimation, and having gone to both of them?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't answer this diplomatically.
of course.
In that, France for me is where my heart and soul is because it's the one I imprinted
right.
with. But I love the Italian embassy because I absolutely adore Italian food and Italian people. So I really couldn't say which one is better. They're so different.
That is
and their
very diplomatic.
Are different.
You could run for office on that one. Well, let me ask you this. I read somewhere that French got their cooking from Italy.
A lot of the more formal haute cuisine traditions and dishes that we think of as truly French, that's actually true from three particular monarchs. And first, Louis XIV is credited with some things, with the multiple course, served on fine silver. He also introduced some of his favorite dishes like raw oysters and asparagus. But it was Catherine de' Medici who very importantly brought Italian chefs with her and introduced things that the French had really never dined on before, sorbets, sauces. She brought with her some of the bread traditions,
mm-hmm.
Pastries. Those are the kinds of things that we really think of as French, but really came with her and her Italian chef. She introduced macaroons, zabaglione, frangipane tarts, and then another Italian, Marie de' Medici, who came from Tuscany, she introduced other kinds of sauces. And she brought coffee and introduced that to the French. Imagine France without coffee now.
Right. Well, imagine coffee without baguettes.
That's right.
Yeah. So, compare the embassy dinners from Italy and France.
Well, it depends on whether you're going to one of the more formal affairs. For example, the Italian embassy does an absolutely gorgeous New Year's Eve celebration. They have musicians playing Italian music. They have Italian opera singers singing music from various Italian composers. They have exhibits of sculptures by famous Italian sculptors. There may be a film shown by a very famous Italian filmmaker. And then to eat, they'll have an array of Italian breads and cheeses and antipasti. Then they'll offer a range of Italian sauces and pastas to go for the primi piatti. Then they'll also have roasted chicken served with grilled vegetables in a balsamic dressing. And then they'll also offer vegetable dishes. And then for dessert, they'll offer a range of Italian chocolates, panettone bread, and then, of course, Prosecco to drink, and Italian wines and Italian beers. And, of course, throughout, Italian music is being played outside of the room where the singers are. Now, if you go to La Fête Nationale, what we call Bastille Day at the French Embassy, it's a whole other different kind of celebration because it's their Independence Day and it's done in July, mm-hmm. which is very hot here in Washington.
Right.
And but what's nice is we get to sing the Marseillaise, and the French ambassador always addresses the crowd in French and talks about the history and the tradition of American and French diplomatic relations, which goes back to the Revolutionary War here in the United States.
Very much so. Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and the crew.
That's right.
Sure, yeah. And the food?
And the food is unbelievable. There's wine from all of the French wine regions, of course, but there's a table just for French cheese, a table just for French pâtés, and you'll find cheese from every region in France in every style, with a gorgeous array of French baguettes, brioche, all the different kinds of rolls. And then there'll be entrees that are served. Usually it's very simple because it's so hot out and they want to keep things not heavy.
Sure.
And so you'll get nice, very simple roasted chicken or a nice French ham from Bayonne. And then you'll have a table that's just for desserts, and you'll have mini pastries, and you'll have chocolates, and you'll have another kind of French-style brioche that comes from Nantes that's got sugar on it that goes very well with coffee. And there's always coffee at the end. And champagne is always flowing because it's a celebration.
What's the difference between French and Italian cuisine?
Well, I would have to say that although they're both regional, French cuisine is considered one of the three royal cuisines, and their cuisine developed over time but was also heavily influenced by the monarchs of France.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll find that the regional cuisine tends to be more rustic and based on the locale.
Rustic versus refined, then.
That's right.
Huh,
and then you'll find the haute cuisine that's in restaurants and served at great events is much more refined.
Okay, I have to take a quick break, but when I come back, the big question of all, what would Summer Whitford serve as ambassador to the world to sell the world on America? When we come back, do stay tuned. Well, so little time and so much to talk about with Summer Whitford, author of Join Us at the Embassy. And let's join her at the Embassy of the United States of America. And she is the ambassador. Summer, what are you going to serve the world to sell them on the character of the United States?
Well, I've actually served this meal before to my adopted family in France. So this is what I put on my menu. Crab cakes from the Chesapeake, chowder from Boston, Maine lobster, fried chicken and black-eyed peas from the South, Kansas City barbecue,
ooh,
Tex-Mex, salmon from the Northwest, and wines from Oregon, New York, and California.
Wow. Okay, that works. So that's kind of like provincial and rustic, right?
And also regional, too,
mm-hmm.
so that we really, unless someone wants to argue about it, I do believe we have regional food just like any other country.
I would assume
that.
So, you know, not the homogenization of restaurant industry notwithstanding, I would agree with that. And I would agree that you would find that probably best in farmers markets and whatnot, local restaurants, locally owned restaurants. But hard to find that, you know, in the chain restaurants that serve the same thing from the same factories everywhere in the United States. But
that's true.
That's not what
we're
talking
about. And
I would
also probably serve a buffalo burger.
A buffalo burger from Montana.
Yeah.
All right. Ted Turner would be very happy about that.
Well, in my catering business for years, I had a member of Congress who was had a large American Indian contingent in his voting block, and so we used to serve a lot of American Indian food. So,
which would be?
Well, depending on which part of the country you're coming from, Indian tacos.
Oh, okay, good.
Indian tacos are made with flatbread, a buffalo-style chili, and then you put lettuce and tomatoes and cheese and onions on top. And it's one of my favorite things to eat.
Mm-hmm. From my neck of the woods, they favor something called fry bread. But I'm not sure. Yeah. So they have all kinds of their delicacies, too. I sometimes think that some of the best American foods came before before the white man and after the Indians had the horse, you know, and they could... They owned the prairie, boy, they sure ate pretty high on the hog, as it were, during
those
times.
Actually, about 80% of the food that we eat now came from American Indians.
80% of the food?
Yeah. Corn, potatoes, tomatoes, all of those were unknown to the Europeans.
Aren't we kind of, though, like the Afghans? You know, aren't we kind
of
on the great Silk Road of the world? And I think everybody lives here, and everybody that lives here brought their foods with them. And I can remember when I was, you know, being raised in Montana, our diet was pretty simple, you know, meat and taters and whatnot. But I remember, you know, when I went to Cal Berkeley, I was studying Chinese, and my mother kind of picked up this notion that she could cook Chinese, too. So when I went home, there she had a wok, and she was making these wonderful Chinese dinners there in Montana. And isn't that really America now?
That is. We really do epitomize our concept of the melting pot, literally, in our melting pot of cuisine.
And that's who we are.
That is who we are. We have become, finally, through our cuisine, what we have claimed to be culturally for so long.
And if we just focus on eating and drinking and enjoying each other's meals, we would probably be a lot happier country.
It's very difficult to go into conflict with someone when you've broken bread with them.
Summer Whitford, author of Join Us at the Embassy, thank you so much for joining us. I'm moving to Washington, D.C. for a year to schmooze around the embassies myself. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Join us next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.